In the United Nations program which follows, you will hear Douglas Fairbanks Jr., Dennis King, and Edward Mulhare.
Ladies and gentlemen, silence please and everybody rise. The court is now in session. The court of human reason, of conscience, of retrospect and prospect, the court of inquiry into a matter touching the question of life and death.
Disarmament on trial. United Nations Radio presents an inquiry into the problem of disarmament, its past, present, and future, its complexities, possibilities, and pressures. The judge is human responsibility. The issue is human fate. The jury is you. You are served notice to attend.
A year has gone by since we last convened. A year without disarmament. Why do we meet again? Well, that is reason enough. That year without disarmament. Let the clerk of the court read the indictment. The indictment of these 12 sterile months.
Count one. In the pursuit of arms, the nations of the world have continued to spend incalculable sums of money, disclosed and undisclosed, upon the means and weapons of war. Count two. In the pursuit of arms, the factories of destruction have been nourished with new wealth, while men have starved, hospitals fallen into disrepair, and schools not been built. Count three. In the pursuit of arms, men have tested weapons of diabolic effect, adding a man-made fraction to nature's decreed quota of poison in the air. Count four. In the pursuit of arms, men stand ready to annex the unmiled regions of outer space for the intercontinental missiles of their common distrust. Count five. That by bringing about the forementioned facts and situations, and that by proving unable to eliminate the fears and suspicions which give rise to them, these past 12 months stand guilty of a high misdemeanor towards humanity.
You have heard the indictment, the charge sheet of accusation. Place alongside it now another account. The balance sheet of attempt and effort, of plan and continuing purpose. Let the United Nations step forward.
Your Honor.
Place before the jury, sir, your official information. Tell the court how the tally stands in the world's disarmament account. How effort squares with urgency.
The problem, Your Honor, is under constant review. Both in their own chancelleries and at the conference tables of the United Nations, governments are giving it thought of the highest priority. In the past 12 months, many old plans have been reviewed, and some half a dozen or more new ones put forward. Some are addressed to one phase of the problem, some to another. Some deal with conventional arms, and some with atomic weapons. Some concentrate on the present danger of atomic radiation, and some seek to guard against the unknown perils of the looming future. In the coming months, all these plans, proposals, suggestions, and ideas will be examined again in microscopic detail by five men representing nations described by the General Assembly as being principally involved in the disarmament question: the four major powers and Canada. I think the UN's disarmament account shows, Your Honor, that effort does not lag far behind urgency.
Thank you, sir. And kindly stand aside till we call on you again. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you have heard the indictment of failure and also the statement of effort. Behind the two, there arises an old question with a new vigor. Are we engaged in the quest of the Holy Grail? Is disarmament possible, or are we pursuing some unreal utopia placed forever beyond the reach of men? So lean back in your jury box and open the introspective inquisition into these questions of life and death. Summon to mind the pro and the con. Give utterance to despair and lend hope a voice. bring forward the contesting counsels of dejection and perseverance. Hear both why we may not hope and why we must. Begin first with your darkest thoughts and give the voice of frustration the cue. Will the learned counsel for pessimism step forward, please?
Your Honor.
Are you prepared, sir, to present your side of the case?
Prepared, Your Honor, though little preparation is necessary. My case speaks for itself.
And the learned advocate for hope, is he also present and prepared?
Present, sir, and also prepared. I bide my time.
Good. Then will the first counsel please address the court?
I think, sir, I can waive my opening oration and summon directly my first witness. History.
History! Is history in court? History!
Here I am. Coming.
Will you step up to the witness stand, please?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was napping. But then I have been working overtime of late, and I haven't been able to get in much sleep for quite some time. I am sorry.
You swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Truth? The whole truth? Nothing but the truth? Well, to tell you the truth, Your Honor, I am a little unhappy about this judicial formula. You see, I have been interpreted in so many different ways that I scarce know myself what it is that I've really been up to in my long and complicated years. The only truth I know is that there are many truths.
I'm afraid I didn't quite get that remark. Could you repeat it, please?
Oh, forgive me, Your Honor, but I never repeat myself.
Quite. Proceed, sir.
Sir History, will you tell the court, sir, how long men have been in search of disarmament?
Ever since they came out of the tree, sir, and started walking on their hind legs.
And when was the first weapon used?
When the first quarrel started.
And how long ago was that?
Oh, a very long time ago. In fact, so long ago that I do not have any clear recollection.
Exercise your memory, sir, and tell us how men came to discover the use of weapons.
Well, now, it would not be so much a matter of my memory, sir, as of retroactive imagination. And many would challenge it.
Leave that to the jury, sir.
Very well. In that event, I think that it was one of your ancestors. Forgive me, he didn't look very much like you.
Thank you.
Not at all. He was, to the best of my recollection, a Dryopithecus.
A what?
A Dryopithecus, Your Honor. Oh. A man-like creature that roamed the pristine forests of the Miocenic Age hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Quite so. And how did this this pristine citizen discover the use of weapons?
As I reconstruct the event, Your Honor, the Dryopithecus in question was walking, I can't think of a more appropriate phrase, walking along one day in search of food, or perhaps it was feminine company, or something, when he came across another Dryopithecus. Now, this other Dryopithecus had what the first one was looking for. And for a moment, the two eyed each other, breathing heavily the while. And then one of them spied a stone lying near at hand. Ooh-hoo, he said, a stone. Well, it seems that a chain of cerebration followed this act of physical recognition. Perhaps the thought process of Dryopithecus ran something like this. The stone is hard, and that dirty Dryopithecus is soft. Now let me pick up hard stone and throw it at dirty, soft Dryopithecus. That will hurt him, and he will yell. Well, the reasoning was impeccable. It did hurt, and he did yell. And that, sir, is how we judge that the first weapon came into use. Give or take a few details. And that is how and why weapons are still used today.
How many wars, all told, have men fought?
Since I began keeping written records, I list approximately 6,000.
And how many disarmament plans, proposals, meetings, committees, commissions, and conferences have there been?
I have no time for quiz programs, sir.
I realize that, but it's important to get the record straight. Has there ever been any successful disarmament agreement?
Only in a very limited sense, sir. Not worth mentioning. My records show that not only has no disarmament plan succeeded so far, but that each disarmament conference has tended to become, in fact, an armaments conference. Each side has tried to come out relatively superior to the other, promising to give up some weapons in the hope that the other could be fooled into giving up even more.
Can this process ever change?
I am history, sir. Prophecy is not in my line.
Thank you, sir. Your witness.
No questions.
You may step down, sir, and thank you for your most authoritative testimony. Any other witnesses?
By your leave, Your Honor, I should like to summon now a witness most learned in the law which lies closest to the issue under inquiry. I wish to interrogate next the science of politics.
Political science! Will political science step up to the witness box, please?
Yes, here I am.
Do you swear to tell the truth?
Stop. I beg, Your Honor, that this oath be waived in my case. I deal with a science whose frontiers are not yet exactly mapped. With me, truth is but a hypothesis, and theory must serve for fact. I can only give my opinions.
Your limitations, sir, are recognized, and you are absolved of the oath. We know that this will not make your testimony any the less valid.
You are generous, and I shall endeavor to be cooperative, sir.
First of all, sir, would you define for the court and the jury the exact nature of your studies?
I am concerned with man in society, with his organizational relationship to other men, and with the evolution of the nations and states in which that relationship is expressed. In short, I seek to know the inner nature of mankind's political institutions.
Then please tell the court what, in your view, is the reason behind national armaments.
Oh, there are a variety of reasons. Nations need arms for conquest and for subjugation. They call this arming for profit. Nations need arms to show their power. Call this arming for prestige. Nations also need arms in order to make their voices more clearly heard by the ears of other nations. You call this arming for diplomacy.
What would you say is the most impelling reason?
In the last analysis, the reason is but one, and it can be put in one word. Survival. Survival, or call it self-preservation, if you like, is a basic, unalterable law of life, all life. It is the inviolable law of nature. It is the organic law which makes us breathe.
Can the world legislate disarmament? Can it pass a law against arms?
It can, but it'll be no more effective than a law against breathing. Where survival is at stake, disarmament is impossible. When their lives, or interests vital to their lives, are threatened, nations, no less than men, will defend themselves with whatever means they can find at hand or can devise. And this, regardless of any agreements to the contrary.
Thank you, sir. Your testimony has been most lucid. Your Honor, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I think I need go no further. History has spread before you its pages, strewn with the wreckage of 1,000 hopes for disarmament, and political science has given you the reasons behind these wrecks. Pessimism rests its case. The anatomy of frustration has been laid bare.
May I leave now, sir?
Just a few brief questions before you go.
Yes.
Questions which may throw some further light on the matter we're inquiring into. You said, sir, that men arm themselves as a means of self-preservation.
Yes, sir.
You drew an analogy between men and states. You said states arm themselves for the same reason that men do.
That is so, sir.
Is it not a fact that within national societies today, men no longer go about armed?
That is a fact, at least in most national societies today.
What made men in national communities give up their arms?
The development of the rule of law, sir. A common law was evolved which gave each individual a common protection. The function of individual defense was taken over by the nation state. The right of self-protection was individually recognized, but no longer needed to be individually exercised. It was exercised on the individual's behalf by society as a whole, within the framework of an agreed social order.
And now, sir, kindly extend this reasoning to states as opposed to individuals. Would you not say that just as individuals found it useful, necessary, and possible to seek individual security through social organization, so also nations can find it useful, necessary, and possible to seek national security through international organization?
Indeed, yes, sir. Yes, all this is possible in theory.
And in practice?
In practice, there is a vast difference between national society and international society. Nation states can give security to their citizens. International society, so far, cannot. Within nations, there are courts with power to say the last word in all disputes, and with policemen at their elbows to make sure that that word is obeyed. In the international world, there are no comparable institutions, no comparable guarantees of justice and security. And in the absence of such guarantees, no nation can be expected to surrender its national means of national self-preservation. That is the law. The law of armaments. The law of self-protection.
Most forcefully put, sir. But address yourself for a moment to this question. What if weapons, instead of ensuring self-protection, should lead to self-destruction?
I don't think that I follow you.
You will when the next witness is heard. For the moment, sir, let us have your answer. Brief and clear, yes or no?
Let me
put it to you again.
Yes.
Would nations willingly hang on to means of self-protection which have, by their own inner logic, become means of self-annihilation?
No, sir. Given that hypothesis, the answer would be no.
Thank you, sir. You have been most helpful. Your Honor, I near the end of my case, the case for hope. I need only call one witness, a witness speaking in the name of another science closely related to the science which we call political.
Certainly. His name?
The science of war.
Science of war. Is the science of war present in court?
Here I am, sir.
Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do, but I may add that it is superfluous to make me promise veracity. Truth is my inalienable nature. I deal in death, and nothing is truer than death.
We are all aware, sir, of the great destruction implicit in the new means of warfare invented by your science. Describe to the court, if you will, how effective the new weapons would be if actually used in combat conditions.
National calculations are still secret. The full data has not yet been made public.
Well, just give us a broad idea.
Well, let me put it this way. It would be possible, through just one act of hydrogen bombardment, to cause as much destruction as that caused by all the wars of all the centuries put together.
Would you say that this fact has added a new dimension to war and altered its political significance?
Not only has it given war a new dimension, but it has radically altered its inner nature. It is no longer what it was. It has become its own opposite.
Explain yourself, sir.
Well, wars are fought to serve national ends, be those ends what they may, aggressive or defensive. Today, any war, no matter with what weapons it starts, stands in danger of becoming an A war or an H war. And such a war would not serve, but would, in fact, destroy its own end. It would obliterate all parties, aggressors and defenders alike. And nations do not go to war to obliterate themselves. That is what I meant by saying that wars had become their own negation. They are no longer practical as a means of pursuing national policies.
Just one more question. Tell me, if nations do not find a way of ridding themselves of these weapons, what is the prospect before them?
I prefer to reply to this question in the phrases of men more authoritative than myself. Premier Nikolai Bulganin has called it the destruction of civilization. President Eisenhower has called it race suicide.
Thank you, sir. Witness is yours.
No questions.
In that case, I may well rest my case here. The case for hope. And the case rests on a paradox. A most powerful paradox. Man has so perfected his instruments for the expression of discord that he must perfect now the institutions of cooperation. Step by step, he has climbed to the final pinnacles of distrust. He can go no higher and must begin the descent on the other side of the slope. He has followed the logic of his national loyalty to a point where national loyalty alone has become illogical. In short, your honors, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my case is simply this. Men have armed themselves to a point where they must now disarm. Thank you, sir.
Silence, please. Silence. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you have heard the learned counsel for pessimism and the distinguished advocate for hope. It only remains for me to sum up. But before I do, I invite the United Nations back to the witness stand for one point of explanation as amicus curiae, a friend of court.
The United Nations, please.
Here, Your Honor.
Sir, the United Nations has been seeking a solution to the disarmament problem since the first year of its existence. 11 years is a long time for the pursuit of objectives. Why have the nations failed to achieve what they all claim to desire?
Your Honor, learned counsel for hope spoke just now of a paradox. The reason for our failure, at least today, lies also in that paradox. The very fact of a possible total destruction, which makes disarmament necessary, also makes it difficult. The very fact which makes modern weapons of war useless as weapons of war makes them at the same time indispensable as weapons of retaliation.
Could you elucidate that line of reasoning, sir?
The thought, Your Honor, is simple. No nation possessing such weapons can afford not to go on possessing them, as long as other nations that are unfriendly possess them also.
The thought, as you say, is simple. But isn't the answer just as simple? Why can't all nations, friendly and unfriendly, disarm simultaneously?
That, sir, is the point where simplicity ends. It is agreed by all that we've reached the point of technological advance where any nation, having the required industrial know-how and facilities, can manufacture thermonuclear weapons at will. It is also agreed by all that it's possible to carry on such manufacture in a clandestine way in violation of agreements. And finally, it's also agreed by all that as yet, no scientific means exist to detect such clandestine violations. There's your dilemma. Weapons have become so destructive that only a few, a mere handful, could spell disaster. And since only a few could do this, no nation can afford to leave any undetected in unfriendly hands.
Would you say, then, the problem is insoluble?
No, sir. No problem is insoluble. Or put it another way, no problem is ever really and finally solved in itself. It merely flows along with life and merges into other problems and acquires other shapes as life creates new settings around it. It is in this fact that our principal hope lies.
Once again, sir, I have to ask you to explain.
Gladly. Take the disarmament debates in the UN.
To the public eye, the deadlock has appeared to be immovable, final, and static. In reality, however, there's been much give and take, much movement, much shifting of positions, as the facts of the external world have shifted.
Where do matters rest today?
I think, sir, I can say that there's a fuller and a more general realization that the problem of disarmament is but one aspect of the whole complex of international life. Consequently, the tendency today is to seek not one dramatic act of comprehensive agreement on this one front, but to push forward, no matter how slowly and painfully, on all related fronts simultaneously. A little agreement on disarmament here, making easier a little lessening of political tension there. A little lessening of this tension in turn opening the way perhaps to yet another step forward to disarmament.
You believe this method will serve?
It must, Your Honor, because it's the only method which the facts of life make available to us. In the last analysis, disarmament is a question of organizing security for all. And security for all can only be organized by organizing a world order for all. And this world order, Your Honor, can only be built when nations realize that they walk tallest when they walk without fear. And that to walk without fear, they must walk in lawful, unmarshaled step.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, our inquiry ends and the time for deliberating a verdict arrives. Before you have been laid the pro and the con. You have been told why the world may not hope for disarmament, and also why it may, and it must. You have heard of the logic of history which leads men to nation-states, and you have heard of the political logic which leads these nation-states to arms. But then you have heard of yet another logic, the logic which burns with a fire of doom behind the unrepressed symbols of the nuclear algebra, the A, the H, the ICBM of total catastrophe. Is disarmament among sovereign nations a foregone failure? Or does this new algebra of death carry, concealed somewhere in its lifeless symbols, some yet unsuspected equation of life? The issues are clear. Can the world disarm? And will it disarm in time? The decision rests with you.
Disarmament on trial. You have been listening to a feature program on the problem of disarmament. The judge was Douglas Fairbanks, Jr. Counsel for pessimism, Edward Mulhare. Counsel for hope, Dennis King. Witnesses were Arnold Moss, Court Benson, Louis Van Ruten, and Vincent Tovell. The program was written by Gol Oberai and directed by George Movsham. Produced in the studios of United Nations Radio in New York.